From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we learn about the enduring legacy of Japanese internment camps through the book Setsuko's Secret. Then we learn about the lesser-told history of women of color involved in the suffrage movement in America.
Suffrage is a footnote to American history for most people. And then once you get into it, women of color who were part of the suffrage movement become even more of a footnote.
Plus, a look back at Schuster's Holiday Parade, a relic of old Milwaukee that would bring around 300,000 spectators.
The showstopper was Santa Claus at the very end. And what made it unique was that he had a team of real live reindeer who were pulling his sleigh as actually the streetcar, you know, kind of pulled it through town.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The internment of Americans with Japanese ancestry during World War II is a part of this nation's dark history of racial discrimination. And like many painful histories, these stories have often been hidden, both by the country that committed these injustices and the people who endured them. Although lawyer and author Shirley Ann Higuchi knew her parents had been incarcerated at the Heart Mountain internment camp in Wyoming, they didn't talk much about it. It wasn't until her mother passed away that Higuchi learned just how much the camp had impacted her mother's life and its enduring legacy in her community. Her journey learning about her own history and that of her community is detailed in her new book, Setsuko's Secret, Heart Mountain and the Legacy of the Japanese American Incarceration. Higuchi joins me along with her aunt, Kathy Saito Yule, a Milwaukeean who was born at Heart Mountain. Shirley, this book was really written in light of your mother's desire to keep at least part of her life hidden from her family and kind of sequestered in a different part of herself. Your book also explores this story of racial persecution and subjugation, not just through her story, your family's story, but through the stories of other significant families as well. Why did you decide to tell it this way?
Well, that's actually a really good question. You know, when I actually joined the board after my mother passed away from pancreatic cancer in 2005, I knew shortly thereafter, probably starting in 2008, that I would start recording the stories of a lot of the former prisoners and Japanese American families that I was meeting at pilgrimages and other events. So the book actually started out more of just interviews and chapters of individual families. And I tried to get each of the Nisei to sort of represent each chapter and write and be part of that. But the history of the Japanese Americans, especially the Nisei generation, has been known as being the quiet Americans. They don't feel comfortable as talking about their past experiences and wanting to put it behind them for a variety of different reasons. And as such, I was told over and over again by publishers and editors that this book would be much more effective as a memoir. In other words, kind of my journey after my mother's death, discovering the significance of Heart Mountain and the history of the Japanese American incarceration that impacted my family, both on my mother's side, the Saitos, which Kathy, she was the youngest daughter, and the Higuchis, which is my father's family.
It's a fascinating story to go through, because as you say, people often didn't want to talk about this pretty traumatic event that happened not only to them, but their community. And this was such a life-altering experience for your mother, your community, and ultimately you yourself in ways that weren't really clear until your mother's passing. What has it been like exploring this history that shaped the person that really both of you are today?
Well, I think from my perspective, and Kathy will obviously jump in, I think that, you know, ironically, you know, I think both of our experiences are very different, and they're also in many ways very similar. I think for me, you know, with my mother and my father not really talking about it much, and then growing up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is a predominantly white and in some instances African-American community, I really didn't have a lot of exposure to other Japanese Americans. I mean, I was very much removed and grew up in a white black environment. So when you have a parent that doesn't really talk much about an incarceration experience, you're isolated geographically and you have very limited exposure. And, you know, back then our history books really didn't talk much about what happened to the Japanese Americans during World War II. As such, it was pretty, you know, a mind-blowing experience and almost sort of starting from scratch on my mother's deathbed, really making it very clear. And Kathy was actually there when this discussion took place, that my mother's memorial money, or her koden in a Japanese term, she wanted her memorial dedication to go to Heart Mountain. You know, to be that surprised or shocked about something that appeared to be at that moment very important to my mother is a very life-changing, revealing secret. It really makes you realize, as a daughter of a former prisoner, that this is something that was really, really important to her, even though she never talked about it. And I think the lesson is, just because people are silenced by an experience doesn't mean that it doesn't have great meaning to them. I mean, it did to her. And I think my journey after, you know, going to Heart Mountain, because they dedicated a walking trail to her after her death, I was very reluctant about participating, because it's hard to participate in something that you don't understand or you don't know anything about. But my life-changing event was actually going there for the first time and seeing the sea of people and dignitaries that were there to honor my mother about something that I knew very little about. And so the beginning of the book and the ending of the book is the journey of me learning about my mother's and family's incarceration experience and getting to know the people that she knew as a child throughout her camp years into adulthood until her death. And it really allowed me to see a very different side of my mother, which, to be quite frank, was a very positive view, you know, a very welcoming view of her. So just think about how much I would have missed by not having that experience of meeting the people that knew her before, during, and after the war.
I have to agree with Shirley. I was invited to join the board, the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation board. And I have to honestly say, I didn't know much about the other incarcerees either. I was astonished to hear some of the stories. The suffering that they had, you know, some would say worse after camp. And my older brother would also attest to that. He, of course, passed away. However, he said that coming back from camp, there was a lot of racism. And it was only after he went away to college back east that he felt like he was a part of some community. The students had accepted him. And there was not that racism or words that were thrown. You know, Jap was one word that was commonly used. I do recall instances as I was growing up in, you know, grammar school, less so later. But, you know, it's a derogatory term that had been used quite a bit. Perhaps less so now. It's frowned upon to use.
You know, as you mentioned, Kathy, There were a lot of consequences to internment that aren't always discussed. And Shirley, before, you know, you said you grew up in a community that was mostly white and black. You didn't learn that much about internment in your history classes. And I would guess that even today, a lot of American students don't learn that much about this history. I think many people will be familiar with Executive Order, I don't know if it's called 9066 or 9066, but it ultimately led to the evacuation and incarceration of American citizens of Japanese ancestry. Your book, though, gets into really what led up to that order and how it was implemented. Can you give us some insight into what that looked like?
There was a lot of pre-war racism and discrimination against Asians historically. And so the bombing of Pearl Harbor and the issuance of 9066 by President Roosevelt was sort of like the explosion with the explosion. But the environment on the West Coast, especially in California, was very rich with prejudice and hatred and economic competition. My father's family owned 14.25 acres of land, and they were very successful farmers. There were a lot of jealousies from the farming industry. As a matter of fact, one of the biggest lobbyists during that time was the Food Growers National Association that asked for the ouster of the Japanese and the Japanese farmers. Other groups also included fishing associations. There was a lot of jealousy around Japanese fishermen. So economically, by taking the land and the businesses and the fishing industry away from the Japanese, essentially opened up, you know, a free-for-all economic boon for the white community on the West Coast during that time. And, you know, as a result, a lot of the economic possibilities were not easily recouped or gained after the Japanese Americans were incarcerated for 3 or 4 years. They had really no home to go back to, no businesses, and their land and their businesses were sold at pennies to a dollar, or they just had to virtually give it away. So yes, you know, the 9066 order was very, very, very terrible. It was unconstitutional, and that has been proven by courts since. But the reality, like any environment, like the environment that we have today in the United States against certain ethnic groups like Muslims, as well as, you know, the Mexican communities, et cetera, a lot of that is stuff that always existed, and it's usually some event that causes it to get a lot worse.
If you're just tuning in, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers, and I'm speaking with Shirley Ann Higuchi, the author of Setsuko Secret, as well as her aunt, Kathy Saito Yule, who was born at the Heart Mountain internment camp in Wyoming. Life in the camps, as your book describes, was difficult. But as you just mentioned, the difficulty didn't end with incarceration. It really lasted beyond that through business ventures, through discrimination in a variety of ways. How did that impact your generation, the next generation after incarceration?
You know, that's a very interesting and probably psychologically framed question, because I think what it ends up doing is it opens up an area in which, like for myself, being a lawyer, you begin to examine the unconstitutionalities and the unfairness, the essential unfairness of discriminating against one group and rounding them up. But I would consider it an awakening. I think it's also a discovery for children of my generation. And I think it allows, if possible, it allows you to independently examine and assess your family history and use whatever talents or skills you have to sort of rediscover our roots and use our talents to tell that story.
Going back to the impact it had on the different generations, in my case, being sort of like one generation ahead of Shirley, I saw my parents after camp. Now, this I do recall very vividly, and including my siblings and, of course, Setsuko, Shirley's mother. It wasn't easy to come out of camp and to find work. And my father, who had a business prior to the camp experience or the relocation or incarceration, like others, tried to find a job, and it was very difficult. I recall that he worked as a busboy at a club in San Francisco, the St. Francis Yacht Club. And he was wearing his uniform. And that doesn't fit the image of my father later in life. He worked hard. He managed to save enough money again to not only feed his family, but also to start another business again. And his store was in Oakland. And I recall, for me, growing up, that Christmas was the worst time of year because I never saw my parents. And this is where my sister, who was 13 years older than I, was also my mother. And that's a hardship that my parents had to endure after the war, because the family was important, but they had high expectations. And I think it was thinking about the children and what they wanted for them was a legacy, at least that they helped them provide the best education. And that I know was really important with my family and with other Japanese American families. They were high achievers, and there might have been a lot of pressure placed on the children. But I think the intent was that the Issei, the first generation, wanted to see, and the Niseis too, wanted to see their children become successful. And there was some collateral damage with that, as with any other group of people who are immigrants. They come and they have high expectations for themselves and for their children. But I think Shirley's book captures some of the pressures that have been given to the generations that followed.
From reading the book, there is this clear, enduring legacy of what incarceration meant for the people who were incarcerated there and what it meant for your community. What do you think the U.S. as a whole has learned from Japanese internment and still needs to learn?
Well, I think we're still learning. I think the U.S. government, as well as other countries universally, including Japan, which I've been doing a lot of educating and work with, that everyone is still learning. I'm a lawyer and I work in Washington, D.C., and a lot of my work are with non-Japanese American judges and lawyers. And it's astounding, you know, the real high level legal scholars like professors and federal judges are aware of the unconstitutionality and the illegality of the Japanese American incarceration through very numerous Supreme Court cases like Korematsu and the Endo case, et cetera. So I would say the majority of most lawyers and judges do not know and understand the depth and range of the Japanese American incarceration and the problems legally around what had actually occurred. So even Justice Scalia, who is now since deceased, has gone public that it was the worst decisions that the Supreme Court made by allowing something of this nature to go forward. But in terms of continuing the education process, I mean, that's the reason why I believe this book that I've written on the history of Heart Mountain, as well as the museum itself, which is an internationally well-known museum at the very site where Kathy was born and where my parents and my family members were incarcerated, is very important, because the best remedy against racism and illegal acts is education. And by books, films, as well as this museum, it'll be a chipping away of the lack of knowledge on something that was quite significant in our history. And I think it'll actually become more significant in the future when people really, really, I mean, really understand what happened at Heart Mountain in 1942 and 43 and throughout the war years.
Two key figures that play into Shirley's book are Senator Al Simpson and Secretary Mineta, who was a transportation secretary under George W. Bush. And I think what he said, this is George Bush at the time, that, you know, with what had happened after 9/11, there was a backlash against those of color and the Arab Americans. What George W. Bush said was, you know, we can't have what happened to Norm, that's Norma Mineta, we can't have happened to these people as what happened to Norm's family. So I think that message sort of started some people thinking, but as Shirley said, there's still a lot of racism that has to be dealt with, but we're making slow headway. And that's part of what the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation is trying to do. It's one of their mission statements.
Kathy, Shirley, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Well, thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
Shirley Ann Higuchi is the author of Setsuko Secret, Heart Mountain and the Legacy of the Japanese American Incarceration. She's also the chair of the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation. Kathy Saito Yule is Higuchi's aunt and was born at the Heart Mountain internment camp. Saito Yule lives in Milwaukee and recently joined her niece for a virtual event through Boswell Book Company. You can learn more about their story at setsukosecret.com. After the break, we'll learn more about the Black, Indigenous, and women of color who were involved in the suffragist movement. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. This year is the centennial anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment, granting women the right to vote. While many of us may think of suffragettes as white women in Victorian dresses, there were many other women involved in securing the right to vote. Finish the Fight is a book that focuses on the Black, Indigenous, Latina, and Asian women who were crucial to the suffrage movement. This collective biography is written by New York Times senior editor Veronica Chambers and the staff of the New York Times. Chambers spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in August, on the day of the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment.
Veronica Chambers, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So as we come up on the anniversary of the 19th Amendment, and I was looking through the book, Finish the Fight, there's something that really just caught my attention right away. There's a banner that says, Lifting as We Climb, and I was struck by just how it resounded with me and the truth that it encompasses about many women, you know, not just this movement, but as a group.
Yes. You know, that's one of my favorite. I'm glad we're starting there. It's a phrase that comes from a speech that was given by Mary Church Terrell, who was an African-American suffragist. And what is really great about it is that it really speaks to the idea that, you know, at their best, suffragists were really equal rights people. They were human rights people. They were working on so many fronts, not just suffrage. And they were just trying to get to this idea of the more perfect union. And they felt that women and their voices was really integral to that.
Yes. And Mary Church Terrell also became the first president of the National Association of Colored Women, a coalition of more than 100 local Black women's club, and this was their motto as well. And your book highlights many of these women, you know, Black people of color, Indigenous, Latinx, so many people that we're not very familiar with when it's maybe a footnote in our history courses to begin with the whole suffrage movement. And despite the 19th Amendment being a cornerstone of what we see as gender equality in the U.S., many of us know very little about the way the right to vote was won. So why do you think it hasn't been viewed as the radical movement that it really was?
You know, it's really interesting because when we started this project, you know, over a year ago, one of the things we asked ourselves was, what do we not know about suffrage? And we actually sent out a survey, just an email survey, to 30 women scholars, historians, curators, writers who cover this subject. And one of the things that they said was that we don't know suffrage because we're not actually really taught enough about women's history. And it was 2016, actually, and Slate did this study, and they said out of 614 works of popular history from 80 publishing houses, more than 75 had male authors. And so, you know, it's interesting because not that men don't write about women, but it's not the norm. And so if you'd like think about just the number of books that are published, much less the curriculum, you realize suffrage is a footnote to American history for most people. And then once you get into it, women of color who were part of the suffrage movement become even more of a footnote.
Right. And what is framed by a few white women. They were older. you know, maybe the Victorian dress puts this concept in our mind that it was a prim and proper movement that everyone was patient to do, you know, but that's, it's not the case. And how did you want to change that and frame this book to highlight more of the unknown history?
Yeah, you know, one of the women that we've sent an email to, who's now writing for the New York Times and has just become really integral part of this process, she said that suffrage sort of needs a renovation, suffrage history. It needs a like makeover, and that we think of it as this kind of like boring history of nagging spinsters, but it's really the story of these badass political strategists who fought for three generations to get women the vote. Because I think that's the other thing, is that we forget exactly how long it took. It took a long time.
Very much so. So to start, I'd like to talk about the Haudenosaunee influence and Native American women who you bring to light. So how did the Haudenosaunee tribe in particular give inspiration and a model to the early suffragettes and especially their first convention?
Sure. So the first convention of suffragettes, it's so funny because I'll just say the diehard historians, they like to point out that in Britain, they were called suffragettes, but here it was actually suffragists, which became a really hard thing for us to change. But, you know, it's okay. I mean, people here used it as well, but it's kind of a complicated word. But the first suffrage conference was 1848, Seneca Falls, upstate New York, and it was actually located in the territory of the Haudenosaunee. And that is also, sometimes the Haudenosaunee are also known as the Iroquois. That's a name that's known a little bit more to people. And one of the things that the women, I think in particular, Elizabeth Cady Stanton noted was that the Haudenosaunee women had political power. They had a say in who this chief was. They had a say in whether or not this person stayed in power. And so for them, I think there was this feeling of, you know, there's this very back and forth that goes on for over 100 years with white women suffragists and Native American women. And there's a sense of both admiration for all the power that the Native women have in their tribes, as well as a sense of, well, if we're who we are, then why don't we have that too? And so there definitely was like influence and inspiration, albeit in a complicated way.
Juxtaposing that early inspiration to, you know, another example of the way the U.S. government broke down many people, I want to highlight Suzette LaFleshy Tibbles. She was a first reservation teacher and ended up later on being a translator for Standing Bear in a case that was basically fighting for the right for Native American people to be counted as a full person under the law. Could you tell us a little bit more about her?
Sure. So both Suzette LaFleshy Tibbles and Zitkala Saw, who was also known as Gertrude Bronnen, they were part of this generation of Native women who were sort of sent to primarily to schools that took them off the reservation and tried to like sort of assimilate them into mainstream culture. And she was really important because she was a translator, but she also brought the case to the judge for Native rights for Standing Bear. And what's really interesting is we did a piece, we have a whole collection page, it's just nytimes.com/suffrage. And we did a piece with a scholar who studies Native American history and suffrage, Kathleen Cahill, and a lawyer named Sarah Deer, two contemporary women. And they were saying that in 75% of cases brought by Native American people for Native rights in the US government, they lose more than 75% of the cases. And this has been historic and it actually continues now. So for this woman at that time to stand up was really powerful.
Yeah, and Black women, of course, also played a big role in this movement, despite the debate within the movement about granting, you know, for example, Black men the right to vote before women when slavery and abolitionist movement kind of was playing a push and pull within the suffragists. And I think one woman who really highlights this turmoil is Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. And she has this great quote that I think is indicative of what movements continue to reckon with and fight today. And she said, I do not believe that white women are dewdrops just exhaled from the skies. I think that, like men, they may be divided into three classes, the good, the bad, and the indifferent. And I just think that is a resounding statement that can be put through any period of history in any movement.
Yes, I think that she was someone, it was interesting. I mean, Nell Painter talks about the history that Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote of suffrage and how much more room that people like Sojourner Truth got than Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. And I think there's definitely a push and pull, especially towards the end of the 19th century, where you get this, you get these Black women who are saying, we want to work on suffrage, but we want to work on it on our own terms. And they're not afraid of being critical of white women, and that immediately causes conflict. You know, France, I love that you brought her up, because Frances also has, I think, the quote that is one of the definitive quotes of like suffrage in particular and democracy at large, which is the, we're all bound up together in one great bundle of humanity, and that society cannot trample on the weakest and feeblest of its members without receiving the curse in its own soul. And I think, you know, it speaks to 100 years ago, 100 years before that, and the moment that we're in, this sense of interconnectedness.
Right. And I found it a really interesting historical fact that, you know, maybe we should have known her name before Rosa Parks, and that Frances refused to give up her trolley seat, you know, and just one of the many things that spurred her into political action. You know, we always think of, you know, the bus movement and things like that. But to have this example much earlier in history was very telling in what is told, as you've mentioned, like what is written in history and what isn't.
Exactly. And I think one of the interesting sort of cool things that you discover when you spend even a little time in suffrage is that every moment of political intrigue, strategy that we think about from our lifetimes or our parents' lifetimes has an echo that goes back. So Rosa Parks is what I grew up knowing about, but there was also Frances Ellen Watkins Harper and a whole slew of women. Mary Terrell had a trolley car incident too, where these women, it doesn't become a movement right away. It happens again and again over decades. And then finally, the barriers start to break down.
One role that a lot of suffragists, but also particularly Black suffragists that I noticed throughout your book, is their role in the written word. So for example, in early 1890s, Josephine St. Pierre Ruffin started a newspaper called The Women's Era, a first newspaper by and for Black women. And she also applied to attend a convention of the General Federation of Women's Clubs here in Milwaukee. And since we're Milwaukee's NPR station, I really, you know, highlighted this, and especially lacking the DNC, I suppose I'm looking for convention stories here. But her role in helping to integrate the women's movement based on this incident in Milwaukee, could you tell our listeners about that?
Sure. So first of all, I just have to say, as an author, it makes me so happy, and I know it's going to make my co-authors so happy too, that you read our book so carefully. And definitely, so Josephine Pierre St. Ruffin, one of the interesting things that you realize is that a lot of the Black women suffragists were very fair-skinned, and she was so fair that she could pass for white. And so she applied, she never hid her color. You know, like you said, she was the publisher of the first suffrage newspaper, primarily for Black women. But when she arrived in Milwaukee, she came from Boston, she traveled by train from Boston to Milwaukee, and she was headed to the convention, and she actually waved to two Black children. And when the white women saw her do that, they realized that only a Black woman would address these Black children with such affection. And when she arrived at the convention, they confronted her and asked her about her race. And she said, you know, I am Black, I never tried to hide that from you. And they insisted that she return her delegate badge, and they wouldn't let her attend the convention. They actually tried to rip the badge off of her dress. And she left not being able to participate, but with her pride of standing up for herself and her color. And so when she got back, she tried to turn the Women's Era paper into the Women's Era Club and really just kept trying to make a place where Black women could speak their voice and be their full selves within the suffrage movement. But the incident, the confrontation in Milwaukee was so notorious that it actually was written up in papers of the time and called the Ruffin Incident.
And on a note of papers at the time, you know, the role of print media is massive in the suffrage movement. And I'm curious for you personally, in your job and being around print and writing, what struck you the most when you were researching these women and reading their words and looking through all these primary documents?
Well, I think there were so many things. I mean, it was exciting to see how much journalism becomes part of the suffrage story, since we're all journalists and we have dedicated our careers to that. Also, I think for us, of course, Ida B. Wells is such a huge figure. You know, she wrote Southern Horrors and other writings, and it was a book about one of the first books to document the lynching of Black men, the violence against Black men that was not being persecuted in the South. And while we were actually looking through proofs of the book and doing our copy edits and our last reads, she received a posthumous Pulitzer this year for her work. And the committee decided to fund more journalism, more journalist students, more up and coming journalists in her honor. So that was, I think, a real moment where we thought, God, you know, it's not just names in our past. These women are so meaningful to us today because they talk about how they really, I think, shine a light on how important it is to get the word out there, and that journalism is not activism, but it is a cornerstone of any democracy.
What else do you want readers to come away with in learning about these women?
You know, I think that strategy is a big part of it. The fact that I didn't know before I started working on this project that suffragists were the first group to ever picket the White House, that they had this idea that Woodrow Wilson, they should be the first thing he saw when he woke up in the morning and the last thing he saw before he went to bed. That kind of thinking, the pressure, I think is really important and interesting. I think also the, like you said, the way they wrote newspapers and books and articles, but also, you know, something really fun to dive into that we don't dive into in our book as much, but we actually do in the New York Times online, is how cartooning was a tool of suffrage, and that women cartoonists sort of stepped to the fore because they, a lot of times the anti-suffrage cartoons portrayed women in such unflattering, really base ways, basically implying that women who wanted the vote were monsters, that suffragists got smart and they said, okay, if you'll draw those cartoons, we're gonna draw other ones. And those helped change the tide too, because having those cartoons in newspapers and over the family dinner table started to get people comfortable with the idea that a woman who votes is not a monster. She's a woman just like your mom and your sister and your aunt and anyone else that you love and admire and want the best for.
Well, I know there's so much more we could go into and take up our whole show with, but Veronica Chambers, thank you so much for your time and your work on this book.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Veronica Chambers is the editor for Narrative Projects at the New York Times. She and the staff wrote the book Finish the Fight, The Brave and Revolutionary Women Who Fought for the Right to Vote. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in August, and you can find more information at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, then learn about the Schuster Holiday Parade of Old Milwaukee, which included some real-life reindeer pulling Santa's sleigh. That's when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Parades are an essential part of the holiday season. Whether it's the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade or a local parade full of friends and neighbors, Parades allow communities to celebrate through music, costumes, and over-the-top floats. For many years here in Milwaukee, Schuster's Holiday Parade was the pinnacle of the season. From 1927 through 1961, the parade drew hundreds of thousands of people into Milwaukee's neighborhoods and featured live reindeer at the head of Santa's sleigh. Historian John Gerter wrote about the parade for this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and he joins me now to talk about it. John Gerter, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure, Joy. Virtually as well as live in the past.
So Schuster's Parade for many years was a big part of the holidays here in Milwaukee, and Schuster's itself was also a big part of the city. For people like me who may not be familiar with it, what was Schuster's?
Schuster's was the biggest department store chain in the entire state. And that's saying something back in the 1800s, early 1900s. It was founded back in 1884 by a German Jewish immigrant named Edward Schuster. And he established what was a kind of a smaller store on 3rd Street. And then he had a couple more branches on the north side. And what really made it take off was his son-in-law, Albert Friedman, who was an entrepreneur of the first magnitude. And he began a building program that ended up putting up these big, they're all still here. The stores are still here. The flagship was on 3rd and Garfield, now Martin Luther King Drive in Garfield. And they built two more stores of the same size on 12th and Valete and down on 11th and Mitchell. So the remarkable thing about Schuster's was that they were the biggest department store chain in the state and they had no downtown location. No, they were never downtown. So what that really underlines to me is the strength of the shopping districts in Milwaukee's neighborhoods. And the famous phrase, you only hear it as kind of a surviving legend, but the way that a lot of Milwaukee Germans would sort of torture, you know, the English syntax and kind of come up with their own phrases. And the most famous one was, meet me down by Schuster's, where the streetcar bends the corner around. So, and there were three to choose from. You could meet people down by any one of those three Schuster's. So they were a very big deal. The Boston store was a big deal. Gimbel's was a big deal. But Schuster's, you know, for much of the 20th century was larger than both of them.
Well, and Schuster's had this kind of hallmark parade, which now when you think about parades, you do think of department stores like Macy's. How would you describe the parade itself?
There were no balloons. Not sure what they were doing with helium back then, but they didn't have balloons like Macy's. But the parade, this thing was, I think it was 7 miles long, you know, so it really went all the way around the city. And what made it unique was that it ran on the rails of Milwaukee's streetcar system. And back in the days before freeways, obviously, the way people, most people got around was by streetcar. They go back to the 1890s. So there was a very well-developed system of rails in Milwaukee streets. And they arranged the route very clearly to go past the Schuster stores on 3rd Street, King Drive, Bleed Street, as well as Mitchell. So that's a lot of real estate. So they had to kind of use a variety of transfers, you know, in terms of how a commuter might have used the streetcar system to get to all those locations. So it was something that attracted people from all sections of town, and where they would build those floats, this is essentially kind of a, in some ways, a lease arrangement. The We Energies was the parent company of the Electric Railway Company as well. Back in those days, those early days from 1896 or so through the 1950s, they were sort of a hybrid of traction, the streetcar company, and lighting and power. So the whole point was to have kind of a 24-hour load of transportation during the day and power during the day and light at night. So the main shops for the streetcar system were out there right north of the Miller Brewery, just west of Harley-Davidson, out there on about 40th and Valete, just to that area. And the Schuster's crews would kind of commandeer those shops beginning back around even before Thanksgiving. And they would use flat cars as their bases. And a little like people might remember building homecoming floats when they were in high school. So you'd start with kind of a flatbed of some sort, flatbed truck, and build from there. This was a much larger scale and much, much more sophisticated, much, much more artistic. And they would choose themes, Cinderella, Peter Rabbit, Three Little Pigs, and all the kind of Christmas themes as well. And those would kind of ride on the rails. And that became the kind of the signature of the Schuster's Parade. And of course, the showstopper was Santa Claus at the very end. And what made it unique was that he had a team of real live reindeer who were pulling his sleigh as actually the streetcar, you know, kind of pulled it through town. And they were tended by, as they called him, a genuine Eskimo named Metic. So the reindeer lasted for decades, but as you can imagine, you know, animals can be somewhat unruly. So by the end of the parades, the parade era, they were replaced by stuffed reindeer. But it was unique. It was a unique spectacle. And they would draw, you know, at a time when Milwaukee's population was, I don't know, 500,000, 400,000, they would draw 300,000 people to this parade. So especially in the busy streets like Mitchell or Vliet, through downtown, it was just thronged. It was a very big deal.
It does sound pretty magical with, you know, the reindeer kind of pulling the sleigh and a lot of the things that we associate with parades today, different kinds of floats themed for the holidays. There was also a breakout star from the parades, a character called Billy the Brownie.
Yeah, Billy was, he was too small to be featured in the floats because he was, you know, as brownies tend to be, diminutive. But he was described as Santa's advance agent and helper. And Schuster's was advertising anyway. You know, obviously the Christmas season's a huge one for retailers. So as part of their onslaught of advertising for the holiday, Schuster's would file these kind of breathless reports from Billy, who I think it was a woman's voice. If you go down to the County Historical Society over Christmas, they'll often have, I'm not sure if they're doing it again this year, but they will have all the broadcasts, you know, of Billy. And he would kind of talk about where Santa was, and not incidentally, you know, there'd be kind of a plug for Schuster's as well. He was also a figure in the newspaper as well, kind of a cartoon character. And he was something of a hero, a little like Tinkerbell and Peter Pan, kind of a hero to the kids of the era. A lot of people who are now in their 70s, 80s, perhaps 90s, you know, kind of go to bed, you know, kind of during the holidays dreaming of their childhoods, you know, their encounters with Billy the Brownie.
It's funny to us now, but at the time that these parades were happening, they developed a lot of new characters that were associated with Christmas. I think even characters like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer versus the rest of the reindeers that are supposed to lead Santa's sleigh. Rudolph is a relatively new addition.
I believe that's right. And I don't honestly know, Joy, whether or not there was a red nose on one of the reindeer that was pulling Santa and sort of shepherded by Metic. You know, but yes, you're right. No, that was part of popular culture. Metic himself, and this is something I hadn't known, you know, until I worked on the Milwaukee Magazine article. He was actually a member of a family who actually herded reindeer north of Nome, Alaska. So he really was kind of the real deal. But this was such an important deal for Schuster's and such a big gig for him as well that he actually moved to Milwaukee. His English name was Daniel Lupson. And I found an article in the Milwaukee Journal doing research for that story saying that he lived on North 39th Street and he worked in Schuster's service department. So he was a Schuster's employee, kind of worked in the service area during the year, most of the year, but then he got out his mucklucks and his probably sealskin coat and got up on the float every Christmas holiday. He also, during the off season, there's an interesting story. He gave a program to Milwaukee area schools called An Eskimo's Childhood. So he was someone who was kind of a cultural ambassador for kind of Aleutian Alaskan Native Americans. And he was someone who also he carved and sold Eskimo kind of knickknacks and tchotchkes. And he was someone who kind of maintained his culture in a place where there really were not many Eskimos here in Milwaukee.
Yeah, of course. We're a little far south to have
right.
too many Inuit folk. Ultimately, what led to the demise of Schuster's Parade?
part of it was the streetcar tracks were being torn up decade by decade. The first buses began to appear in the 1920s. And the streetcars continued to run. The last one ran in 1958, but that was just kind of a special out to the Sea Braves games at Milwaukee County Stadium. So the Schuster's folks had to kind of improvise. Now, the route was changed as the system was dismembered. They finally gave up in 1955 and consigned the rest of the parade to trucks. So it lost something of its magic, something of its allure. And probably the biggest change was that Schuster's was purchased by Gimbel's in, I think, 1962. And Gimbel's decided, big downtown location. Oh, there was kind of they were an anchor down there on the Wisconsin Avenue with the Milwaukee River. And they decided to kind of throw in with the downtown parade. And what that meant was that the neighborhood-oriented parade was expendable. So the last Schuster's parade was 1961 and survives today only in memory.
A fun bit of Milwaukee history to take home for the holidays. John Gerda, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure, Joy. Happy holidays.
John Gerda is a local historian and the author of several books about Milwaukee history, including The Making of Milwaukee and Milwaukee, City of Neighborhoods. His piece about Schuster's Parade was featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.